Hello there. Let's turn this one on too. Okay, now let's turn that one off. Good. Nice. Happy Monday. How many of you aren't here because you got caught in a blizzard? All that snow, but not in Vermont. Bummer. They can't use it in New York City. All the good it did in New York City was keep Julie from coming home. She called me yesterday afternoon, said she would try to make it today. And I said, no, you won't. She said, I'm in an apartment overlooking Central Park and they've had 2 feet of snow. I said, then why don't you put on your boots and go play? But don't try to drive home before the roads are clear. So she didn't. But you know what really made her sad? She was really sad that she had not taken your exercises to New York with her so she could finish grading them. So she apologizes for that. She did get about half of them done before she left and said they were very good. You're really understanding the material and describing it well. And so.
Yes.
Good. She said she was going to try to have them done by Wednesday, but I wouldn't count on that. So we'll see. We'll get them back as soon as we can. Questions? Housekeeping or otherwise? You're easy. Okay, so we were talking, I think, about systems. And I was elaborating a little bit on what happens in a system, and this is important because Bronfenbrenner's entire framework is a way of understanding the ecosystem. And so far, we have put together the elements of relations and types of relations and their characteristics, activities, and roles, which we've talked about individually. And then we've said that in a particular setting, you have a system, a microsystem, of the roles, relations, and activities which establish a pattern created by and maintained by the people who are present and active in that setting. So the microsystem, we would expect to have all of the characteristics of a system And a system is a group of components or elements or parts. In this case, the roles, relationships, and activities, and of course the people who fill those roles and do those activities and create the relations. They are the elements that create a pattern in which the roles, relationships, and activities and the people create a system within that particular setting. So the microsystem is the pattern of roles, relationships, and activities created and maintained by the people who are in that setting. And it has the characteristics of a system, including that if you change any one part of the system, other parts will have to adapt to that change. So whoever's in the setting, all of the people who are relating within that setting are going to have to adapt whenever any one of them changes. and the pattern, therefore, the system itself will change. That change may be temporary, or it may be long-lasting. Systems reflect any change that occurs within the parts itself, themselves, or that impinges from outside in a way that changes the way people relate or the activities that they can do. So this ought to be review for you. I think we're all fairly familiar with the way systems operate, but it's important within Bronfenbrenner's framework to be thinking always that the entire system is going to change if any one part of it changes, and the parts of the system are the people, the roles, the relationships, and the activities, and the way they are patterned, the way they hang together, will change if any one of them changes, or if there's an impingement from the outside. Another characteristic of systems is that they tend to be always a bit out of balance. Living systems tend to be out of balance and seeking a comfortable, familiar, stable way of relating to each other or performing their duties or the job that the system is set up to do. So we're always looking for moving toward a stable way of relating to each other, carrying out our activities, seeking some kind of routine in that system. So that's a tendency of systems, a tendency to find a stable way of functioning. And if you're disturbing any part of it, there'll be a response to that which will tend to bring it back into a stable state. If it can't reach the old stable state, as if the change in some part is permanent, then it will look for a new stable state. And it'll settle in eventually to a routine, again, a stable pattern of roles, relationships, and activities. And that's adaptation. The systems change constantly as the individuals in them or their roles or their activities change. So change is fairly constant in systems, and it's always attempting to find a familiar or comfortable way of relating so that whatever that particular system defines as stable will be maintained. So systems always resist change as they try to maintain their homeostasis or their stability. And if they're permanently disrupted, then they will create a new homeostasis. They'll find a new stable state. Okay, so systems are always working to maintain or find, create a new stable state. Okay. If you're not affected by what goes on, you're probably not part of the system. Okay, a couple of characteristics in human systems or social systems. We tend to create our pattern of activities and relationships fairly quickly. We tend to. Some systems are inherently unstable because change is happening so regularly that it's difficult for the system to find a stable state. And when it is in what we call disequilibrium or an unstable state, the roles and the relationships tend to be a little more conflictful. There's a little more anxiety in a system that is disequilibrated. Okay. So when you disturb the system in some way, people tend to get upset a little bit and then settle into a new pattern. And social systems tend to find their new patterns fairly quickly. If they don't, then you're creating constant change, and as I was saying on Wednesday, I believe, Change is always inherently stressful, even if it's something that you want to have happen. So a system is trying to find its stable state, and if it can't because things keep happening, they keep changing, then the system is upset, and it's more difficult then for people to figure out what their roles and relationships are. So as systems experience repeated change over and over again and can't find a stable state, then people have difficulty knowing what their roles are and maintaining comfortable relationships. So systems that experience a great deal of change, more than they can adapt to, so they never find or rarely find a stable state, or if they do, it doesn't last very long, those are difficult for people in those systems. They're experiencing stress, they're not sure what their roles are, their relationships are disrupted. The longer the people in a system work or play together or live together, the more likely they are to find and maintain a stable state, as long as they're not experiencing regular change. And the more stable the system is, the more it resists change. So if a system has functioned the same way, if a family system has functioned the same way for a long period of time, they haven't had to experience change, then when change does happen, they're more likely to resist the change, to try to keep the old system in place, resist the change, not have to adapt to it. So we can describe systems as very stable or less stable. We can describe them as having been stable over a long period of time or having just reached stability. We can describe them as in flux or in disequilibrium, trying to find a stable state. Okay, that's typical of living systems in general, and it's necessary to understand that in thinking about a family, which is a system, and a system of roles, relationships, and activities, experiencing fairly regular change. So we can think about a family or a group that adapts fairly quickly to change, that accepts it, doesn't resist it, accepts it, and says, okay, we've got to modify the way we do things here because things have shifted. And you can contrast that with a system that resists the change and say, no, you can't grow up. You can't go through puberty. You can't change your role. You can't have more power in this relationship. You can't express more affection because you're going to make us all uncomfortable. But we're going to resist that, and we're going to find ways to resist it. We'll call you names. We'll shame you. We'll just not go along with the changes that you're trying to make in the system. That describes different approaches to the typically developmental change that happens for individuals. We all go through changes. Does our system support the change and adapt to it comfortably and help us adapt to it? Or does our system resist the change and make it uncomfortable for us to grow? And you have a continuum from very adaptive, supportive systems on one end to very resistant to change systems on the other. Okay, questions about systems? You all grew up with systems theory, right? You know about systems of living things and social systems. Questions about details or implications of that? You're comfortable with the notion that a family or a work group or the residence of a residence hall, or in my case, the program that I teach in, that we are a social system. That's okay. Okay. Back to microsystem. Again, just a reminder, the pattern of activities, roles, and interpersonal relations experienced by the developing person in a given setting with particular physical and material characteristics. Now, the point I want to make, you've got the roles, relations, and activities. But what I want you to be aware of and think about is the middle phrase, experienced by the developing person. Now, Bronfenbrenner uses developing person when he wants to focus on a person who's developing, typically a child. But that same emphasis applies to everybody in the system. Each person in a microsystem is experiencing a different microsystem. There is not a microsystem in the setting that everyone experiences the same way. Each person is experiencing a different microsystem. It's the same microsystem, but they have a different view of it. And that's important when we look at family systems for a couple of reasons. One is, as you'll read in one of maybe you won't this semester. It's typically a cliche to talk about the fact that in a marriage, you have two marriages. You have his marriage and her marriage. And they have different views of the marriage because, strangely enough, each of them is married to a different person. Right? So he's seeing the marriage through his eyes and the spouse is her. She's seeing it through her eyes and the spouse is him. So they have very different experience of the marriage. That's comfortable, right? Okay, so you've got that. And then you have child one. And then you have child two. And all of their transactions, their relations. And the point that is important is that each of them is experiencing the pattern of roles, relationships, and activities differently. And that's important to keep in mind because two children are not in the same family. When we talk about children being in the same family, and we wonder how they get to be so different, or why firstborns are different from secondborns. You do have an article about that. The explanation for that is those children are not in the same family. They're in the same microsystem, but they're experiencing a different microsystem. And the reason for that is that child one, unless they're twins, child one is a different age than child two. So we'll assume this is firstborn and secondborn. So child one starts off with a mother and a father and no siblings. And then at some point in life, a second child is born. Child one is always the older sibling. It's a fascinating thing about the passage of time. It goes at the same rate for everybody and you never catch up with your big brother. You never become the older if you were born last. We secondborns are just forever junior to the firstborn. So the firstborn has a baby brother or sister and is always the older one. And that's the microsystem that he or she experiences, having a younger sibling and always being first and oldest in the eyes of the parents. Number two, always has an older sibling and is always seen as the younger by everybody in the family. So the parents see the two children differently, even if they think they're trying to see them the same way. But most importantly, the two children are in different families. One has an older sibling, the other one has a younger sibling. That's a very different relationship. So the pattern of roles and relationships for the two children is different, even though they're living in the same household. Easy to understand? Yeah, makes sense. Kind of obvious, actually. Why is he spending so much time on that? Because people often forget it. They often forget it. When they're talking about the effects of parenting, they'll talk about what the parents did to their two children and assume they did the same thing. They'll look at siblings and say, well, these siblings are different. Why would that be? Well, it's obvious. One is older and one is younger. They've had a different set of transactions. They've learned different skills. They've had different power experience because your bigger sibling is often more powerful than you are and typically more experienced and smarter and all of those other things that make your relationships different. So if you're on the lower end or the younger end of that transaction, you're learning very different things than if you're on the older end. And you're experiencing your parents differently because the parents are responding to you differently. Okay? If you're going to understand the microsystem, Bronfenbrenner says you have to take into account the whole interpersonal system operating in that microsystem. All of the participants present and the reciprocal relations between them. All six of the transactional relationships these four people have. You have to think about all of them. And the roles and the activities and the pattern. So when you think you are studying a home, for example, it's important, as a few of you discovered in you trying to describe the microsystem in one of your settings, it's a very complex task. It's a very complex task. What we'll be looking at in Bronfenbrenner over and over again is how a change in one or more of these participants alters the way the system functions. Okay. And you all have thousands of experiences of that in your own growing up. You think about the transitions when somebody has come into or out of the microsystem, when someone's role has changed. The youngest one goes off to school, elementary school, kindergarten. Oldest one graduates from high school. There's that wonderful summer before you head off to the army or to college or to work someplace else when you're no longer in school. Moving ahead, your role is changing. It's an ecological transition for the entire system because of the change in role of one of the participants. And so the pattern of roles has changed. The activities may change. In the Galinsky book, which you'll be reading starting next month, make sure you buy it before the bookstore gets rid of them. In the Galinsky book, the primary point is that as child one develops through different stages of childhood, the parent's relation to that child has to change. And to some extent, the parental roles change because the activities that you have to do with kids who are different ages change. So the relationships change, the parental relationship may change. The book doesn't talk very much about sibling relationships, but that's also important. And the microsystem is, to a large extent, being driven by the developmental change that's happening for children. Okay. As they develop new skills, take on new roles and new activities, then the whole microsystem is adapting. And the book gives a great deal of detail about how parents experience those changes, which are driven by the fact the child is changing. Many of us as parents would be just wonderfully happy to have our kids stay the same all the time, because then we could develop a stable system and there we would be. And some of us are really good with infants, but infants don't stay infants usually. They start walking and they start talking and they start saying no. And then we have to relate to them differently. We have to change the rules. We have to change our activities. We have to baby-proof the house, toddler-proof the house. And as we do that, it creates new demands and new roles for the parent. Some of us are fine with elementary school kids. Some of us aren't really fine and stable until our kids are adolescents. because then they can do the same things we do, and that's fun for us. So families are satisfying more or less depending on how the parents view kids of different stages. And most of us have preferences. Most of us prefer or relate more easily to one kind of child than another. I remember one of the first times I ran into this phenomenon, outside my own family experience, of course, was when I was a graduate student at Minnesota. A group of us were working with a low-income, it was kind of a beginning Head Start. It was just before Head Start, but it was a similar program. And in a poor neighborhood in Minneapolis. And one of the problems, as far as some of the staff were concerned, was that we had a mother who had 7 children. And I think there had been at least 4, maybe 5 different fathers. And she had married number 2 or number 3, I've forgotten which, and then he disappeared, went someplace else. But she continued to have children and was living on welfare, and her kids, the youngest 3, were in the program that we were setting up, and the older were in elementary school. And one of the staff raised the concern that she was going to have another baby, probably. And so somebody said, well, how do you know that? And the answer was, well, the youngest is starting to walk. Well, you know, finish the sentence so I understand what you're talking about. This person knew, had known the mother for a long time, and said, as soon as that baby says no, she's going to need another baby. Because she gets along really, really, really well with babies. She's a great, great baby mother. But as soon as that kid starts saying no, she's going to decide it doesn't like her. And she doesn't know what to do with the kid who says no, which is why the other 6 are all little hellions running wild in the neighborhood, creating problems in school, because she doesn't know how to set limits. She doesn't like to do that. She likes to nurture. She's going to need another baby. Yes, you can. We did. We did. Yeah. We did solve the problem. It was one of the more brilliant interventions that I have ever witnessed, and it was so simple and so respectful and changed the system so much. It didn't change her ability to set limits. Her children were not neglected enough to be taken away. They were just a problem. And they were a problem because there wasn't a dad around and mom really was not comfortable setting limits. So somebody in the group, I wish I knew who, because I'd give them some kind of prize, I'd invent one for them, but I don't remember who it was, said, oh, so I think somebody said sterilization and somebody else said, you can't do that. And the brilliant person said, so we have to figure out a way to keep her baby from growing up. And my devious mind went to brain damage, okay? We'll just, you know, take care of this baby so it doesn't learn to talk and needs her, right? That's not good either. That's the way my devious mind went. But the brilliant person said, we're a child care education program. Why don't we hire her for the baby room and let her take care of other people's babies and pay her for it and get her off welfare? This is called the career ladder in early childhood programs. You hire the parents to take care of the babies, and then you train them to take care of older people, older kids, if you want. In this particular case, We paired free contraceptive services with a job taking care of babies, with the not quite spoken but fairly unsubtle hint that if she got pregnant again, she'd get fired. That's probably illegal too. But you know, we could use you if you were interested in working full-time job above minimum wage with benefits in the baby room, but you know, not if you get pregnant again and have another baby. So I was there 2 more years. She didn't have another baby. And what the staff very unsubtly also added to that was some confidence building and some assertiveness training for her, and an interpretation. The therapeutic interpretation was that one of the reasons she was getting pregnant was so she could have babies. That was part of it. But the other was the misguided notion that she shared with many other women, that if you're sleeping with a man and he won't make a commitment to you and is not very faithful and not very stable in the relationship, one of the ways to improve the stability and the commitment is to get pregnant, because men always, of course, stay around when they have children. This is hope triumphing over experience, because it hadn't happened for her yet through 7 kids, and it wasn't going to happen again because she wasn't attracting the kind of men who might be able or willing to stay around. So part of the therapeutic endeavor was to help her understand that this wasn't working, and that in fact, maybe if you look back at her history, maybe having the babies was driving the men away. This was before we got really good about enforcing support orders. But the men she was getting pregnant by weren't going to provide much support anyway and wouldn't have been able to. But it worked. But it was a wonderful example of somebody being comfortable in a particular kind of relationship, in a particular kind of transaction, but not being able to deal with kids as they got older. So she was recreating the kind of transaction that she needed, and what we did was give that to her permanently. I don't know whether she continued forever, but at least it worked for a couple of years. And then I moved on. I don't know what happened to her. I'd like to think that she retired, you know, went through menopause, at least stayed through menopause, please, and didn't have any more children. Or learned enough in the program that if she did have another child, she might have been ready to grow up with the child. But if you were an infant, she's the one you would have wanted to take care of you, because boy, was she great. Loving, warm, bubbly, just, you know, she was everything an infant needed. But she just couldn't deal with the kids who talked and had their own desires. Okay. You can think about your own family situations, ones that you've been in and one that you've seen, how those change, and also how yours has changed. As an example, most of you left home to come to college. How many of you were the first to leave? Were you able to watch your families adapt to you being gone? They changed their pattern in any way? How many of you have a younger sibling who took over your room? Right? That's one way the pattern changes. They sleep in different places and you are displaced. And when you come back, you are a guest and you better make a reservation, right? Okay. Any other kinds of changes? The younger one, yeah. Right. They did change. The empty nest changes people. They did change. You know how they did. Yeah. They sleep in your room now. Yeah. Sex in your bed. What do you think they're doing? How many of you were the last to leave and left your poor parents home? What do you think they're doing? Some of them are. The happy ones are. The ones you want to be when you grow up are. They are taking advantage of the fact that they don't have to worry about you coming in. They don't have to feed you. They don't have to worry about where you're going. They don't have to play parent anymore and that role that wasn't comfortable for them, trying to get you to do what you were supposed to do and monitoring you and supervising you. They get to go back and be a couple on their honeymoon again. They get to work on their relationship. They get to have sex on the couch without worrying about you coming in. And if they don't, I feel sorry for them. They're missing the opportunity. Okay. But if you have parents together in an empty nest, they are going to take advantage of that empty nest. They may not have sex in your bed, but they'll think about it. And I'm fascinated by the fact that it creates an emotional reaction in you. Didn't you have sex in their bed when they were gone? No. Okay. Something sacred about beds, right? No, don't sleep in it. Okay. The first one goes off to college or to boarding school. The family system changes. Number two takes advantage of that, moves up. Role changes. You're now the only one at home, or the one who's oldest now. The firstborn isn't there to take care of numbers 3, 4, and 5. So now the oldest who has the responsibility is number 2. The role changes. The activities change. The relationship to the younger siblings change. You're no longer under the thumb of number 1, classified as one of the little kids being taken care of and resenting the older child. Now you're the one taking care of and being resented by the younger ones.
I can understand it, but I've noticed in my family, I have 3 younger sisters, and the sister after me is completely incompetent and couldn't, like, my third sister ended up having to take that role, and I don't know, I just kind of wonder how that might end up happening. Yeah. I don't know, it's just not...
The comment is that the 3 younger sisters are different, and number 2 is incompetent. That raises one issue. And so number 3 ended up becoming the competent, responsible one, replacing number 1 because number 2 was sort of out of it, spacey, out of it. Having been abused by her older sister for years and years and years, and having learned to be incompetent and helpless, you didn't do that. Nah. But it raises the questions. The first question and the answer to it is that all kids are potentially different. They're genetically different. Their personalities are different. They are experiencing a different family as they grow up, and they have different roles. So of course they're going to be different. That stands to reason. They're going to be different. In some families, they all look like peas in a pod. That's probably genetics, accident. And in other families, they're no more alike than strangers off the street, which is genetically almost the case, that siblings are not much more alike than any other humans from the same ethnic genetic pool. But what happens is that each kid is creating a role for him or herself in that stable microsystem. And if number 1 has taken on the responsible, trusted child, delegated by the parents to be the ruler of the younger kids, and is taught the skills to take over all of the household functions, number 2 may see that and say, okay, I'm going to be the same way. If her personality is such that she can say, okay, I can do that too. I want to model myself after my big sister. It's a possibility. It didn't happen in your family, but it's a possibility that she will do that. and say, I want to be just like my older sister, and by the time they get off to college, they're best buds, they're interchangeable, they marry brothers, you know, they raise their kids, you know, all of those things. It's also possible that child number two is going to look at that and say, you know what? I can't compete. Going into adolescence, I need my own identity. I'm not going to be a clone of big sister, whom I think is a whatever. Fill in your own. Okay. I have my own pejorative for her. And so I'm going to be different in order to have my own identity, to be recognized as an individual. I can't be just like number one. So I'm going to develop a different role. I'm going to be incompetent. I'm going to be the troublemaker. She wants to do all that stuff. I'm going to let her do it, and I'm not going to learn to do it. Now, sometimes when that happens, what happens is that when number one leaves, number two gets the chance to change. And sometimes, depending again on personality, that you have this open role. Now, the biologists call it a niche. Niche. Something that needs to be done or could be done, and I could move into that now that big sister's gone. So sometimes what you see is the kid who's been incompetent and irresponsible looks at that empty role and says, okay, now if I do that, I'm not going to be compared to her. I'm not going to be her. She's off there in college. They're focused on her. I just get to do this. And other times, they won't do that. But the point is that everybody gets a chance to renegotiate their roles when anyone is abandoned. And in this case, it might mean that she gets the chance to be responsible. And in others, you got number three coming along trying to be number one. So number two is saying, I'm happy, I'm happy, I'm spacey, it may fit her personality more. She's comfortable, she likes that role, and she's going to be just fine. She's not going to discover competence until she has children.
Well, I was going to say, like, when I left, like, my parents relied on me to do a lot of stuff. I mean, my dad got everything, and then the one after me was kind of, like, she definitely was like, I'm not going to be like you, I'm going to do my own thing, yep. Be a pain in the ass. And, but then now that I'm gone and my dad is going away again, she's getting thrown into these roles that she's completely, like, ignored and denied, and she's finding she can't do, like, she can't handle them, she can't do them, like, the housework roles and driving the sisters around. Number three can't because she doesn't have her license yet.
Right.
So she's finding out, I think, the hard way of taking these roles that are more difficult than I think she realizes.
Yep. You had a hand.
Oh, I was just going to say, I have a perfect personal experience. I have an older brother, and it's really hard breaking out of the role of doing what everyone thinks that you should. It sounds like so cliche, but it really is. Huge deal that I moved into the dorm with my brother. He's like, it was the best 3 years of my life. Like, you have to do it. Blah, 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 blah. And now I'm in the dorms and I'm just like, I don't think I want to be here.
Let me out.
What am I doing here? You know, it's just funny. And, like, I'm so scared because he's abroad right now. And I'm so scared to, like, tell him. You know what I mean? Like, I'm really having anxiety. I'm like, what am I
going
to say?
He's just a brother. Telling you, moving out of the dorms, you can't stand it. It was okay for him. He's a guy. He's different. He's not you. You get to be yourself. Have your own identity. I have another one from my childhood, too. I'll show you another story. I'll tell you my sister's story. I have had a brother who was 3 years older, and he was a straight-A student, worked really hard, became a professor, actually. We were department chairs in different universities at the same time. It was bizarre. I was a straight-A student coming 3 years after him, but I didn't have to work hard because I'm smarter than he was. And better in many ways than he was. Our sister, the older sister, was 6 years younger than me. She got to second grade in a small town, so same teachers. And the second or third day of school, the teacher took her aside and said, so you're Ron and Larry's little sister. That's wonderful. They were so good. Such wonderful people. Such wonderful boys. We were both wimps. And neither of us ever got caught doing the things that we did that we didn't want people to know about. So we were smart. In a small town, you have to be really smart not to get caught doing the things that you're not supposed to do. And then everybody thinks you're really good. And Sue came home from school and told Mom what the teacher had said, that she hoped that she was just as good a student as her older brothers. And Sue looked at my mother and said, "I'm not going to be." In second grade, she wanted to be herself. She didn't want to be like us, and she wasn't. And even though she's probably natively smarter than both of us combined, and has demonstrated that in much of her life, she didn't do well in school all the way through. And every time a teacher would say, "Oh, I'm surprised you're not just like your brothers," you know, just pushed her farther to being not like her brothers. She was not going to be like us at all. And you don't have to be. One of the things that really surprised her when she grew up was that when she dropped out of college after a semester, never went back, she figured her two older brothers would never respect her. And she was very surprised when she discovered we both have a tremendous amount of respect for her and her child rearing and her work and her thinking and the way she holds everything together for so many people. She's really good. A PhD doesn't make you really... You know that, right? Okay, we're not going there. What people with PhDs are like at home. Okay. Other examples or observations about the fact that the roles are going to change regularly, and as they change, the whole system is going to change. Parents come and go. Everybody's roles change. You brought that one up. Dad leaves, kids have more responsibility. Mom's role changes when there's not another parent to share that with. Yeah? What about step families? How do those roles? The question is generally about roles as they change and as you bring step children together and step parents together. And that's a wonderful segue into where I was going next. And I'll use that to illustrate. Where I was going next is that if you think about the changes that are taking place in a particular system over time, people are coming in and out of it. Roles are changing and the activities are changing and the relationships are changing. You can begin to draw or sketch out developmentally a series of changes. Rarely, most of us don't live our lives in a single microsystem in a particular setting with exactly the same people. They come and go. And they come and go as people divorce. And what happens with a step union, where parents are remarried, or at least one of them is, and one of them is a step parent, or both of them, if they both brought children in, is that you have a family system, let's call this hers. It had a particular system, and that system led to divorce, which is a series of system changes in itself, and we'll explore later. So now I've got hers and kids, at least part of the time. They are creating a system, and their system is affected by whatever the father's, let's call this mother one, and we've got father one, And they have had a system, they've now made it a binuclear system, a two-household system, typically. So they still both exist, their relationships affect each other, and we're going to go there when we talk about a different kind of system, how those two settings affect each other. And then we have the changes that they're going through. And then somewhere off in the distance, you have another one of these that's doing the same thing, perhaps. And people are changing their roles and adapting their roles depending on the specific system that they have. So mom, who's about to become stepmom, joins up with father two and his kids, and he brings in his experience with a different system, different way of doing father role, a different way of doing spouse role, different expectations with kids. And they put those two together into a blended system that includes mom one and her kids, father two and his kids. Mom two is out there someplace, maybe. She's affecting that one. The kids have four parents, three or four, and different ways of doing the various roles. And when you put these two systems together, as some of you have experienced, you have a good deal of adapting to do to figure out how to live in the same household with a parent who is not yours and a sibling that you don't share genes with. And certainly don't want to share your genes with. You know, get out of my closet. And you may have gone from being the oldest and responsible child to having a step-sibling who's 2 or 3 years older than you, who is now the oldest and used to being the responsible child. And the parents get to figure out which one of you is going to be responsible, and you can't be equal because you're different ages. And so the one who is really oldest gets to be the mature and responsible one, and you get to suddenly be number two, which is quite a demotion. And so you create problems because you don't like this guy in your household anyway, or the step-sibling, and you're competitive. So you get to play out a completely new set of roles, which is step-sibling, step-daughter, step-son, step-father, step-mother. Those are all new roles. And in our society, stepmothers have a pretty bad rap. You know any stories about the good stepmother? No, there aren't many. You know any about the wicked stepmother? Yeah. There are lots of them. So you come in and you get to try to figure out how to be step-parent to somebody else's children who don't want you in the household anyway and resent your existence and put up with you because you foot the bills, you know. Sort of thing. So what you're trying to do now is to create a stable system, and it's being created by people who are being put in new roles, so it's an ecological transition for everybody, form new relationships, and they're taking their old roles that were created in previous microsystems, their ways of relating that were created in previous partnerships, and they're trying to adapt them so that they work in this new system and fill roles that they've never been in before. I've always been the dutiful daughter. I've never had to be a stepdaughter. I help my father keep his life together because I'm responsible and he's okay, but you know, I'm the loving daughter. My stepfather doesn't need or want me to do that. And I can't do it to two men anyway. So we have discombobulation in the system. It's a huge disequilibrium. And that is probably why second marriages with children are even more likely to end in divorce than first marriages. Especially if you create them early on. If you wait 6 years after divorce, if both parents have waited 6 years, you get down fairly low. But the step-family system is inherently out of equilibrium. And it takes a great deal of time to grow into new relationships and new roles. And if everybody is willing to do that and create a system that is unique, then it can be done well. But if you're not willing to change your role, then you will keep the system in disequilibrium until they throw you out, essentially. So what happens is, moms come in to be the kind of mom they think always works, but it worked with a dad who wasn't there. It worked as a single parent, and now you're going to put it in this situation. You've got to learn to share parenthood with your partner. And you think you know how to do it, but you've never done it because you didn't do it in your first marriage. You didn't have to do it in the singlehood phase. Now you've got to do it. You've got to put together your parenthood role and your partner role. And you've got to figure out how to incorporate the child of that new partner who is quite happy to have you as a stepmom, but what his mother did for him all the time was clean up after him and never set any limits on him. And that's not the kind of mom you are. So now he's going to have to adapt to that, and it's going to take you 2 or 3 years to establish that this is the way it goes. And you've got this daughter who was the firstborn and oldest until she was 14 and suddenly had a 17-year-old brother who's now the oldest. It's incredible. Wonderfully complex. Putting together of a new system that has unfamiliar roles. All of the step roles are unfamiliar for most people, except through the media. And you have parenting in a new situation. Remember the dyadic relationship, which is now with a new person, is going to be influenced by the third party and the fourth party and the fifth party in the system, all of whom are trying to adapt to the new relationship. And it goes on and on and on. They're fascinating to study because they are never the same. They're always different. And so, what should you have done? Best approach is to go into family therapy immediately and sort everything out. Support the Family Therapists of America. Second thing that's really, really helpful, particularly if kids are old enough to talk to you and old enough to have questions about it, is you sit everybody down around a table or in the living room and you start talking about how you're going to create a step family. And these are incredibly wonderful, creative conversations that people have, children and adults, saying, okay, Ralph and I are getting married. This is in Massachusetts if Ralph and I are getting married, but anyway. And we've been doing things our way, and Ralph and his kids have been doing things their way. We both have traditions that we developed as a family in our former families, and we have traditions that you want to keep with your mother and Ralph's kids want to keep with their mother, and so we don't have to throw any of those away. But what we do have to do is figure out how we are going to create our part of the family when we're together. And so we get to figure out how we want to celebrate Hanukkah. We get to figure out what we want to do on vacations. And everything is negotiable. So we get to think about what kind of family we all really want to live in. And it's really fun to listen to kids say, I want a family where nobody gets yelled at. Okay, let's see if we can do that. I want a family where kids can do responsible things and not always have mom hovering over them. Okay, let's see if we can do that. I want a family where we have meetings like this every month. Okay, we can do that. So what works really well is if people recognize that they're changing the whole system, they're bringing in elements from the past, but those aren't going to be automatically adopted by the people in the other part. They're going to bring their own in, and now we get to talk about what those are and develop something that we would like to have. as a family. So you get to talk about the values, what you would like to have, and then you get to try to create a system. But what you're doing in that process that's so much fun is you're doing what Bronfenbrenner says human development is. You're developing a valid view of the world that you live in, including recognizing that it's changing dramatically, and you're working on the skills based on that awareness to be able actually to relate to each other in better ways. And if a family, step family, a blended or blurged family can do that, their probability of success and happiness with each other is much better. But what it requires is a willingness of everybody to say, okay, we don't have to do things the way they used to be. We need to maintain some of the traditions for the sake of children or because they're really important to one parent or the other. And that's okay. You put that out on the table and say, yes, I want to maintain this. This is really important to me. And I'll give up this, this, and this, or adapt it. But everybody puts what they think is really bottom line for them on the table, and then you work with those pieces so they create a family that works. The same thing can happen before the blendedness comes up. And part of my work with divorcing families is that there are good divorces and there are bad divorces and there are ones in between. But you can really screw each other up going through a divorce and you can screw up your kids, and we know how to do that. We can teach you how to do that. You have lessons all around you, I'm sure. Or you can do it well, and doing it well often involves the same kind of process. We're divorcing. We're not divorcing you. We're divorcing each other. We want to have the best divorced family in America. And that means we want to be able to communicate with each other, to support each other, to let the parents take their relationship apart and change it, and let both of them continue to parent. We say to the kids and to the parents, what kind of family would be a good divorced family for you? Now, you hear all kinds of things as you talk about that, and many people's idea of the best divorced family is if the other parent would politely drop off the face of the earth and never be heard from again. You can make that happen, but then you go to jail because homicide is, you know, it's one of those things you're not supposed to do. And then your kids won't have any parents, so you don't want to do that. Or you can decide that you're going to have a binuclear family where the parents support each other and their parenting and they communicate effectively, and you know, it only takes most families 5 or 6 years to get to that point, but they do, most of them, eventually. And the ones that do have kids who go through divorce with not a whole bunch of long-term consequences. But again, it's a matter of pointing out to people, and particularly the participants, this is what's happening. You're going to create a whole new system. You've got a whole bunch of new relationships to grow into. They don't happen instantly. Some people think they do. You know, this is my new husband. You're now to call him daddy. Any kid who doesn't rebel against that should lose his childhood. I don't know. That was flipped. Okay, but what you want to do is help people understand that they're going to come to a new stable system that works over time by growing into those relationships.
I feel like theoretically this is like a very ideal way of saying like that that would work, but like my mom is a child psychologist and when she got divorced, she did a lot of those things and was very like open and you know, gave like my little brothers a lot of choices and you know, let them know that they had a lot of decisions and stuff, and that basically did that and said, you know, this is what's going to happen, and I want you to know this and this and this, but, you know, in the end, I feel like, you know, there's still going to be times where, you know, your kids aren't going to be cooperative and they're not going to like it, and it's going to be a bad divorce anyway.
The fact that kids don't like it, and the fact that, the comment, let me repeat that for the people on the web, even doing it well and doing the best job you can as parents isn't going to keep kids from resenting or deciding they don't want to do it that way or having problems with it. And it will be a more difficult divorce than it would be if the kids would just, you know, go with the flow. But if the parents are working to support each other and work with the kids, then it's not going to be a bad divorce. Bad divorces are the ones where one parent or both are uncooperative, not doing their job as parents, giving kids too much freedom or not enough. They're not doing their parenting role, and they're preventing each other from doing an appropriate job of parenting, or they're not supporting each other in doing that. And they maintain the animosity. If parents don't do that, kids will eventually decide to be about as happy as they want to be. That paraphrase from Lincoln, his birthday was yesterday, Abraham, he said, most people are about as happy as they decide to be. You decide to do it, go along with it, adapt to it, or you decide to fight it. And that's a choice that you get to make. One of the interesting things about the divorce literature, which is one of my hobbies, trying to interpret that literature, is that most of the kids who have problems, if the parents are doing a pretty good job, if they're not continuing to throw kerosene on the fire and fighting with each other, if they are doing a pretty good job with each other and trying to do a good job with their kids, most kids will come up to the level of problem they were going to have anyway. And if you look at the kids who have major problems dealing with divorce, they either were having problems before the divorce or their parents have continued to do a bad job through the divorce. The divorce itself doesn't change kids' personalities and their skills unless the parents are really contributing to that process. So most of the kids who have serious problems 2 or 3 or 4 years after their parents' divorce had problems before the divorce. If you look at their interpersonal skills, their emotional behavior before the divorce, it's not usually a consequence of the divorce. What they're doing is using their problem skills, their inadequate skills, to cope with a situation that they can't cope with. And the other part of that I wanted to comment on was that I do a lot of talking about the ideal. And because part of your comment was very appropriate, that even if it's ideal, even if you're doing the very best job you can, there's still going to be things that happen. And that's true of all of life. But if you know what is ideal, and this is in working with divorcing parents, often they don't have a clue what they're trying to do. Shooting the other person would be ideal for them, and getting that person to disappear. And women particularly are often very startled to discover that the father is still alive and still has rights, and even though he's been a schmuck and unsupportive and create a lot of conflict, he still gets to have a relationship with his children, and you're expected to support it. And then they get even more resentful that 5 years after the divorce, he actually wants to spend more time being a dad. And they're very upset by that. So it's very helpful for people to know from the beginning that if you divorce, the other person continues to exist, continues to be a parent, and without you, is likely to want to be more involved as a parent after a while. May take till the kids are 25, but he or she will want to be involved, and you get to deal with it. If you know what the ideal is, if you know what a good divorce looks like, as I tell people, if you know where you could go, then you know which direction to walk. But what you see is people working their hardest to create a bad situation. You see parents and kids working really hard to make a bad situation. And that's not necessary. If you know what the ideal is, then you may not get there, but you can get closer to it than you will if you're trying to get to the to a bad situation. And those are choices that if you know, you get to remind each other, wait a minute, we're trying to have a good divorced family. I'm not sure that what you're doing is helping that. And let's talk about that behavior. So everybody knows that there's an ideal that people have agreed they might want to work toward, then you can push people in the appropriate direction. But I'm an incurable optimist. Pollyanna, my first wife, would say. But I'm not totally out of touch with reality. I know that most of us don't get to the ideal. But we can get closer than we do. And it helps to know that this is what's going on. You're creating a new microsystem. And it's helpful to know that every microsystem exists in a web of other microsystems. And if you look at that web, you're looking at the meso system, M-E-S-O, which is based on the Latin or Greek or something for middle. Micro is the smallest, meso is the medium size system. And that's what I began to draw here in looking at the creation of the blended family. Because what you have is the microsystem that you're looking at, the two parents and the stepkids and all of that, but they are also relating to another setting, which is Mom 2's current household, where the kids may be spending time, part of the time. And you have Father 1's household, where his kids may be part of the time. And the relationships among those three settings, the one that we're looking at with the blended family and the father in the first family's household and the mother in the second family's household, you now have three settings. The relationships among those three settings are the mesosystem. There is a microsystem in each of those. And each of them is influenced by the existence of the others. So what goes on in the blended family, the target family for us, what goes on there will be influenced, that system will be influenced by what goes on in Father 1's household, or Father 2's, or whichever one we, you got it, the people who don't live in this household, but who have influence because they spend time with some of the kids. And the kids go back and forth. So the kids are active participants in these other settings. So for each child, there is a different mesosystem. And the mesosystem is the relationships, the connections between the settings that the kid goes back and forth in. Okay? So review the section on mesosystems, and we'll look at a whole bunch of hypotheses about how settings are connected or linked to each other on Wednesday. Thank you.